From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, drawing the line on the rights abusive parents have to their kids. Patrick Murphy is the public guardian of Cook County, Illinois. He argues that while keeping families together may sound like good public policy, it can lead to tragic consequences. Murphy says our child welfare system is antiquated and needs drastic reform. Also, the hot zones in our homes. We'll talk with microbiologist Dr. Charles Gerba, an expert on household germs. He says every time you wipe your counter with a sponge, you're spreading diseases throughout your whole kitchen. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the pop group Oasis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The federal official who is overseeing the Teamsters Union elections says she's considering whether to bar Ron Kerry from running in the new balloting she has ordered. Barbara Zach-Quindell threw out Ron Kerry's 1996 victory over James Hoffa because of fundraising violations. She had ruled that Kerry could run again in the new election, but now she says new evidence and access to new witnesses may cause her to reconsider that decision. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says there is a long way to go to get peace negotiations back on track between Israel and the Palestinians. Albright met today with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in the West Bank town of Ramallah, and she urged him to stand up to Palestinian militants. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinians had hoped that today Secretary Albright would come out with strong statements criticizing Israeli policies. They were disappointed. Albright focused again on security, telling Arafat that fighting terrorism is not a matter of convenience, but a 24-hour-a-day job. Palestinians saw that statement as a public rebuke of Arafat. They say the secretary is biased in favor of Israel. For his part, Arafat listed what he said were Israel's violations of the Oslo Peace Agreement, including building Jewish settlements and the closure that keeps Palestinians from their jobs in Israel. He said he is committed to the peace process and is doing everything he can to fight terrorism. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Military generals draped the Indian flag over the body of Mother Teresa today to begin the formal tribute to the Nobel laureate. About 100 nuns from her order, the Missionaries of Charity, said prayers during the brief service. Thousands of people lined up to file past her body today as monsoon rains eased somewhat in Calcutta. Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan will appear at a Montgomery, Alabama school next week, despite efforts by the local school board to block the event. NPR's Debbie Elliott has the story.
An organization called the Montgomery Study Group rented the Carver High School auditorium for a Stop the Violence rally next week. But when city school officials found out Louis Farrakhan was a featured speaker, the school board returned the group's rental deposit and said the event couldn't happen on school property. Civil liberties lawyers say the board's decision was based solely on Farrakhan's political message. Critics have accused the Nation of Islam leader of preaching racial hatred. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alabama filed a federal lawsuit claiming the group's right of freedom of expression had been violated. In a meeting with a federal judge yesterday, the two sides agreed that the rally could go on as scheduled September 17th, but the public will not be allowed on Carver's campus until school closes for the day. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down more than 91 points at 7,628 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 9. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is experiencing heavy losses today. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market is being dragged lower by concern about corporate profits. Corning has lost more than 10% after the company warned that earnings will not meet expectations because of slowing growth in its optical fiber and cable business. And Ascend Communications is lower after Salomon Brothers raised concern about weak results. The market is also being pressured by rising long-term interest rates, which are higher on evidence of economic strength. The decline in the number of first-time jobless claims was larger than expected last week. Investors are also anxious about tomorrow's reports on wholesale inflation and retail sales. I'm Doug Krisner.
The U.S. trade deficit narrowed somewhat in the second quarter of the year. The Commerce Department says the gap in the current account, the broadest measure of trade, declined 2.4%. In San Francisco, negotiators worked nonstop for 27 hours trying to end the strike by commuter rail workers, but a mediator stopped the talks last night, saying both sides were tired and cranky. They're expected to try again today. A House Ways and Means Committee panel is debating the success of the North American Free Trade Agreement today. Deputy U.S. Trade Representative Jeff Lang argued that NAFTA has had a modest positive effect on trade, but opponents claim that NAFTA has been a total failure. They point to continuing trade deficits between the U.S. and Mexico and Canada. The hearing is a first step in the Clinton administration's effort to get so-called fast-track authority to negotiate trade agreements. That authority would give the president the needed power to expand NAFTA to the rest of Latin America and into Asia. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Patrick Murphy has worked in the criminal and juvenile justice systems for more than 30 years. As public guardian in Cook County, Illinois, which includes the Chicago metropolitan area, he represents abused and neglected children, as well as senile or disabled elderly people. His new book, Wasted: The Plight of America's Unwanted Children, describes the child welfare system and how it often fails our nation's most disadvantaged kids. Patrick Murphy writes that when he started his job in the 60s, Cook County Juvenile Court handled fewer than 2,000 children. Today, more than 40,000 abused and neglected kids are in the custody of the Cook County courts. 90% of these children are born to women on welfare, and at least 80% have no involved father. Murphy argues that the child welfare system today tends to see the parents of abused children as the victims of poverty, and in its focus on rehabilitating parents and preserving the family, the system loses track of the true victims, the children. This policy of family preservation evolved as a response to the failures of the child welfare system in the past, when abused and unwanted children were shunted from one state institution to the next. I asked Patrick Murphy to describe one such child, Bill, who was his first case as public guardian.
Bill was a kid that was abandoned in the Skid Row section of Chicago, and he came into our system. We gave him a name because no one really knew his name, and an age, and the age turned out to be the wrong age, and an IQ test, which was based upon the erroneous age, and they said he was retarded. He's a very, very dysfunctional young man. Today he's 40. But he was never retarded, but he was locked up in a number of facilities for retarded and then for mentally ill, and he spent 3 years in the local detention facility for delinquents. So pretty much his life was messed up by us and was probably messed up by his parents before he ever came into the system. I mean, he was abandoned at age 5.
Now, why did you start with him, other than the fact that you were making a parallel between then and now?
He was the first. I had been a prosecutor and criminal defense lawyer and also a Peace Corps volunteer before I got into this in my early 30s. And he was the first kid I ever represented. And he brought out a lot of the issues which were going on in those days. That is horrible residential care for kids, kids being taken from parents. Sometimes his only crime was poverty, although he didn't fall in that category. And I like the kid, and I still like him, and I still have a relationship with him, and I suppose for that reason I wanted to talk about him.
Well, he got shunted around from home, residential home to home, to foster care, to here and there. Is a child entering the child welfare system now likely to get the same kind of chaotic moving around?
Not as much as in those days. Relative care has stepped in. So a lot of grannies and aunts and uncles are now taking care of these kids. So they aren't being moved around quite as much as they used to be. But some kids are still being moved around, and some kids are still in not all that hot residential care, although for the most part, residential care is a lot better. You know, what we used to call orphanages is a lot better than it used to be.
Well, you write that one of the main principles driving the child welfare system right now, perhaps driving it in the wrong direction, is family preservation. And you write about one specific case that falls under the heading of animal family preservation. I'd like you to describe the situation your friend, the dog catcher, presented to
you. Oh, yeah. Well, You know, family preservation is something that came about in the 1980s, actually the 1980 Adoption Assistance Act passed by Congress, which mandated that when states got federal funds, as we all do, they had to make actually overly heroic efforts to keep families together, or once the kids were taken out, to put them back in with the families. And actually, I testified on three occasions before congressional committees in favor of this legislation and wrote a book back in the 70s where I championed this legislation. So I was one of its early proponents, and I still think, by the way, it's an excellent idea that has to a large part gone wrong. And one of the cases, and it's actually, in terms of the cases I cite in the book and in terms of the cases I've seen, it's not one of the more serious ones, although it's a little humorous. And in this arena, by the way, if you don't have a sense of humor, you're going to burn out and go away in a year or two. What happened was that back in the 70s, this man and his wife were living in a place with dogs and cats and parrots and mongoose. I mean, just about every animal you could think of. And the police had to come, and ultimately the home had to be torn down. It was in such bad condition, and the children were taken out. That's the background. Back in the early 90s, I got a call from Animal Control Expedite, or whatever they're called, the dog catcher. And he said he had to see me, and I said, we don't take care of dogs, we take care of kids. But he came by, and he assaulted me, basically, and said, listen, I was at this home, the same home that we're talking about, only it was in the 90s now. And they had to break in because the smell was so terrible. The neighbors complained. There were something like 24 dogs in the place. And the father, the husband, was in the corner with his leg being eaten away from gangrene. And the boy, who was about 10 or 11, was covered with feces. And he said it was one of the worst, most inhumane situations he'd ever seen. The windows were locked. It was in August in hot, sultry, humid Chicago. So he said they got the dogs out of this inhumane situation, but he called the Department of Children and Family Services with respect to the child, and they came in and said, well, no problem. All the mother needs is some family preservation funds and a homemaker and a social worker, and she'll be all right. So he called outraged about this, and, of course, we got involved. And the woman was a very, very sick woman who there was no way that this woman could ever, ever take care of that child. And then we had another case similar to that where a woman with the IQ of a six-year-old had a baby who was 6 months old. She was in her 20s. And she had to take the kid to the hospital because he was failing to thrive. The hospital refused to give the child back to the woman because she was so disabled. The Department of Children and Family Services came by and said, no, there's no problem. We've been giving her family preservation for 6 months. They still refused to do it, and then they brought it to court. When we looked at it, we looked at the child welfare report. Even their own report said that the home, after the homemaker had been in it, the housekeeper had been in there, there was debris all over. There was several dogs, cats, a parrot, and a monkey. And you say to yourself, a monkey in Chicago in this home and the six-month-old? Well, you know, maybe that's the only reason the kid survived that long. But they were intent on trying to keep this family together. It wasn't a family. And again, you can feel sorry for this woman, as we should, and she is to be pitied and she is to be assisted, but she is not to be given a child to raise. She can't do it.
Well, explain this to me, why family services would send children, and we hear about these cases all the time, send children back to parents who are obviously mentally or emotionally impaired.
Well, you know, it comes down to various reasons. I mean, number one, once you're in this system, as I have been for almost 30 years now, you understand that even a marginal family is better than the state for raising a child. The state doesn't do a good job. We don't have the resources. And most children have bonded to even the worst parents. So that when you break the bond, it creates all kinds of problems that the kid will never overcome. Now, sometimes, by the way, it's major surgery, and you have to break that bond. And the kid will have problems, but keeping the kid with the parent will create greater problems. So that there are legitimate reasons for trying to keep families together. And what has happened is that within the child welfare system, they have taken this legitimate idea and thrown in a lot of leftover bogus philosophy from the 60s where the poor are victims. Now, most of the people we deal with are very poor, underclass people who are there but for the grace of God go I type of people. so that we feel sorry for them. And then what happens, we combine all this, and then sooner or later, before long, what had happened was that the parents became the ultimate victims, not the child. The parent was a victim of an uncaring society, of poverty, of racism, of classism, and they wouldn't have done this if not for that. So hence, we have to bend over backwards to help this parent because we were the ones who shafted the parent in the first place. So it's kind of this sloppy thinking going on, and because of that, there was a big push in the late 80s and early 90s, and still today in many quarters, to keep families together or to push them back together. And it somehow helps our middle-class mentality and minds and philosophy, but it does nothing for the child.
It seems as if the system treats all parents the same, the evil parents who perpetuate this horrific abuse and the kind of unintentionally neglectful parents who are in trouble and don't have enough money and are in a bad spot in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. There are you get cases of the father who has, I'll give an example. One time I was trying to get legislation passed that would say you cannot provide family preservation funds to people have sexually abused their kids, for instance, until such time as the case had come to court and the judge looked at it. You couldn't do it without a judicial hearing. And I was talking to a group of social workers about this, and one raised her hand and said, but what about the father who sexually abuses his daughter? Do you really want to delay him getting therapy until such time as he can get to court? And I said, is that before or after we castrate him? And of course, they all looked at me like I was the thug that I am, I suppose. But I mean, the point is that there are some crimes or some things that parents do to their children that are so serious, we should get right beyond rehabilitation. There's no rehabilitation for someone who tortures his child or murders another child when you come to a sibling or who has sex with a child. You know, we've got to move and say, hey, wait, this man should be prosecuted. But what you see is, and it's, I've been saying this for years, and it's a cliche, but if you go down the block and have sex with the kid down the block or torture the kid down the block, you're going to do 30 years. If you do it to your own kid, you'll get a social worker and a homemaker. And whereas that is somewhat of an embellishment, I have seen it actually happen too often, or variations on the theme happen too often, not to know that it is inaccurate. And then you'll get the mom coming in who's got four kids. She's 22. She has no high school education. She had her first child at 14. She was encouraged to have children by a culture that says it's okay to have kids. None of the fathers hung around. She's done a Herculean job of raising the kids. She wakes up at 22, looks out the window, gets depressed, and says, my life is over, as indeed it is. Then she turns to drugs. Her drug supplier becomes her paramour and ultimately abuses her and the kids. You know, this type of woman should get services and should get help, albeit you don't extend it on forever and ever. And there are a lot of things we've got to change about the culture. But we'll treat her the same way we will the torturer or the person who just walks out on the kids and leaves them alone for weeks while she or he is out doing drugs or something. And you can't treat them the same.
Every few months there's some new horrendous headline about a child who has died in foster care or in their home, despite the fact that caseworkers were visiting and monitoring the family. How do they actually inspect children and inspect a home that they would miss this?
I think that over the past couple of decades, the parent has been perceived as the true victim of child abuse in many, many quarters. So that what the worker is doing is concentrating on the parent. I'm involved in two cases right now where children died, in one case, a six-month-old starved to death while the worker was going in every two or three weeks. And obviously he was communicating and dealing with the parents and not really looking at the child. In another case, a three-and-a-half-year-old girl weighed 18 pounds, and the mother ultimately poured scalding water over her vagina and anus, killing her and just burning her horribly. But there were like 40 or 45 different instances of marks and scars on her body, which according to the medical examiner occurred in two or three months prior to that time. Now, in that time, family preservation had been in the home up to four and five times a week, but apparently never looked at the child and just dealt with the mom. In fact, was taking her to lunch. They were providing a housekeeper for her, buying her dressers and things like that. Now, in both these cases, we're involved in lawsuits against the private agencies.
It sounds as if this were incompetence, it's
really much more than incompetence. If it was just incompetence, you could wipe it away. What it is it is the way. Now, it is to a degree incompetence, obviously. In these cases, they should have caught it. But it's also a philosophy that the child belongs to the parent. You know, you can go back to the last century. The child's the property of the parent. Now it's not phrased that way. That's politically incorrect. But that these folks are poor. These folks are minority. These folks have been put upon. These folks never had a chance in life. And we're talking about the parents here. Now, all of that, by the way, is true in most cases. But the focus has to be on the child. Otherwise, you're leaving a child in a situation where he or she has been tortured in one way or another. And that's what we have to protect against.
I'm talking with Patrick Murphy. He's public guardian of Cook County, Illinois, where he represents abused and neglected children, also elderly and senile people. His new book about the child welfare system is Wasted, The Plight of America's Unwanted Children. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Patrick Murphy, public guardian of Cook County, Illinois. We're talking about how our child welfare system fails many abused and neglected children. You write that there's too much lawyering and due process and judging going on in the child welfare system, also in the juvenile justice.
And by the way, I am a lawyer. I practiced law for 33 years in every court from the U.S. Supreme Court on down, so I'm not knocking lawyers when I say that.
What should take their place? Why are the courts not the right vehicle to take on child abuse and neglect?
Well, there's two aspects to the question. The first is looking at it from the point of view of what goes on today, and that is that much of what we do is, you know, we bring in judges and lawyers and court reporters and public defenders and state's attorneys, and we sit around 25, 26, 27-year-old kids, that's not me, who, you know, may be very motivated and very dedicated, but we're dealing with highly complex societal, familial issues. And we're no better able to do it, in fact, in many ways less able to do it than, say, a real social worker with a real master's degree. Now, we provide due process to the families, so we can't take a kid without a judicial hearing. But so many cases, I think, can be resolved in the community without us getting involved. The case of the mother who turns the drugs has no involved father and three or four kids. Normally, she recognizes that she's not doing her kids a favor. And it seems to me that this is a situation where the social workers bring in the grandmother, the aunts, the extended family. They sit around the table and they all talk to her and say, listen, why don't you agree to give your kids to grandma? Grandma will receive the money. You're going to get services. We're going to send you to a drug rehab center. We're going to try to work with you for the next 6 or 8 months. Now, you have a right to a lawyer. You have a right to go to court. You have a right to fight us. And by the way, in 6 or 8 months, if you don't turn it around, we're probably going to end up in court anyway. But this is your chance. And it can be done, you know, by looking the woman in the eye. She can talk to you. You can talk to her. If there's an involved father around, you can say, let's get him down here. Let's talk. It's a much more human way of handling things. It's much cheaper, and it's much better for the parent, for everybody.
So this would prevent those cases in which kids are taken away, and while a woman waits for a court date, the kids sleep in some social worker's office in some federal building because there's no place for them to go to a foster home.
Or move from foster home to foster home while the mom doesn't get visits. It's all done informally. The kid's with a grandma or an aunt, or maybe there isn't a grandma or aunt that's with a foster parent that's not a relative, but at least the mom is set up to visit. And everything can work informally without, you know, lawyers and judges are for major surgery. You know, I went to law school 3 years at Northwestern here. They didn't teach me anything about child welfare. They didn't teach me anything about children. They taught you how to get into a conflict. There was a true conflict and try to do something about it. We create conflicts in the child welfare system when we could avoid the conflict by letting it be handled in the community by real master degree social workers, people whose expertise it is to deal with this kind of issue.
Do we need more orphanages?
I think it's a complex issue. As I point out in the book, one time the ACLU lawyer got up in court and said, orphanages kill people, they ruin people, we should do away with them. And I point out, yeah, my dad spent 3 years in one. Of course, he went wrong someplace because of his eight kids that he sired, and all of whom got advanced degrees. Four of us became lawyers. So maybe the orphanage did follow him up a little bit. Is a family better than an orphanage? Absolutely. But for some kids, you have no option, particularly for adolescent kids. Foster care frequently isn't good for them. Adolescent kids relate more to their peers than their parents. I mean, my own son recently told me that I didn't know everything. For adolescents, I think residential care can be a lifesaver. Right now, I see too many kids living on the streets. And also for some younger kids who go through four or five foster homes, these kids come into the system very, very dysfunctional. They've been through a lot. Their parents have rejected them, sometimes beaten them. They get in foster care and they test the foster parent, test them, and the foster parent gives up. And then they go to another home. And now their self-esteem is even lower. They've been rejected twice. And this course goes on and on until they have nothing left in them. So residential care for younger kids until they get stabilized so that they can get back into the system or go home is also a good idea. It shouldn't be more than a year or two for the younger kids, and hopefully less than that. But sometimes it's absolutely necessary. You've got to stabilize these kids, and foster homes don't have the expertise or the patience to do it.
Well, child welfare, the system is protected by confidentiality laws, which I think you argue in some ways help perpetuate the incompetence.
Yeah, the confidentiality laws were put in place to protect the families. They exist today not to protect incompetence. They exist today to protect the system from the public, because if the public knew the philosophy of the system, knew what we did, there would be an outcry for change. There's no outcry for change because no one knows how stupid the system is. I would do away with the laws of confidentiality. I would give the media unfettered access to every case file of any kid who was harmed while he or she was in the system or serviced by the system completely. And the reporter should have access to every juvenile courtroom and have access to most files. The only way the system is ever going to be reformed is if the public understands exactly what's going on inside it.
I want to really thank you for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Patrick Murphy is the public guardian for Cook County, Illinois. His new book is Wasted: The Plight of America's Unwanted Children. This is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, germ warfare in our homes. Microbiologist Charles Gerba tells us why we're more likely to get sick eating in our own kitchens than at a restaurant. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the third CD from the new British pop group, Oasis.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The more you learn about germs, the more impossible it seems to combat them. According to Dr. Charles Gerba, it's actually better to be sneezed on than to shake someone's hand, because we pick up infections all the time just by touching surfaces and bringing our fingers to our nose or eyes. Germs are Dr. Gerba's territory. He's a professor of environmental microbiology at the University of Arizona and a leading authority on the microbial transmission of disease. Most of his germ sleuthing takes place in people's homes, in their kitchens and bathrooms, as well as in public bathrooms in hotels, restaurants, and offices. I asked Charles Gerba what the most microbial room is in the average home.
Well, actually, the most germ-laden room in the house is actually the kitchen. If you ask most people, they would actually say the bathroom, but and it's actually reversed. The kitchen is your most germ-laden area in the whole home.
And how do you analyze this? How do you go about figuring that out?
Well, we've actually gone into a lot of homes and checked them out microbially. Actually, until a few years ago, we knew more about the microbiology of the moon than your home. So a few people have actually really studied it in this country. And what we've actually discovered, there's more germs that could potentially make you ill in your kitchen sink than actually in your toilet. Actually, it's probably safer to make a sandwich on a toilet seat than actually your kitchen sink, from what we found out. And the reason why probably is because most people use disinfectant cleaners in the bathroom area. They use disinfectant sprays and various types of cleaning solutions that have disinfectants. And they don't realize how important that is actually in the kitchen area too, because you're always bringing in potentially microorganisms that could make you ill on your poultry products, just an example, salmonella, or on your raw meat products. And they can get onto various surfaces in your kitchen area and actually grow to very large numbers.
Reading your research, I wanted to immediately burn all my sponges. Sponges seem to be real hot spots.
Yeah, actually, the sponge is the most germ-laden area of the whole home, we found out. The reason why is because it's always moist, bugs like that, and also you're always bringing food to them. You're wiping up surfaces and picking up food particles and all time, and the bacteria just love that. I mean, the best home a germ ever had was a kitchen sponge. And overnight, particularly if you leave it on the counter, they grow to billions overnight. And every time you wipe a surface, you're actually spreading these all around the kitchen. And in our studies, what we found, some of the cleanest people are actually the dirtiest when it comes to germs, because they're just spreading them all around all the time. Every time they wipe a surface, they lay down a nice layer of germs that potentially could make you ill without really realizing it.
Now, cross-contamination seems to be the worst enemy. Why don't you tell us what it is, and then take us through proper food handling, starting with unloading the groceries.
Yeah, probably the first thing to do is to make sure none of the raw meat products have opened up or you get any juices on your hand, because that's always a sign you should wash your hands right away. You don't want to pick up a broken package of poultry, for example, put it in the refrigerator, and then put the raw vegetables away, like your lettuce, head of lettuce, your tomatoes, and that, because then you contaminated them potentially with salmonella. 30% or more of the poultry in this country contains salmonella on it. Now, when you cook that food, you're going to destroy the salmonella, but usually we eat vegetables, make salads out of them, eat them raw, and that's where the cross-contamination occurs. Other problems happen, like with the sponges. When you wipe up an area, you can spread salmonella, for example, which you're then going to put raw food products on there, and then get it on your hands. Now, you get it on your hands, and you can make a salad or other types of food, which you might eat raw. But also, you may bring your fingers to your nose or mouth. It is particularly important in a small child. A small child brings his fingers to his nose and mouth hundreds of times a day, almost once every 3 minutes. In fact, he touches and swallows the dirt on the equivalent of about 6 to 8 kitchen floor tiles every day. And if there were salmonella or other bacteria on there, he's putting them right where they want to be. I mean, we literally pick up germs every day when we move through the kitchen. If there happens to be one there that can make us ill, then we create a situation where basically we can transmit the germ to ourselves. Now, another common mistake people make is cutting boards. They'll cut up their raw meat products or make a hamburger on it, and then they'll put it in the oven, which destroys the bacteria that could make you ill. And then typically all they do is rinse off that cutting board. And that doesn't get rid of the germs that could make you ill. And you have to really disinfect that cutting board with a disinfectant cleaner or common household bleach, for example.
And how do you clean your kitchen table well?
I think the best thing for germ warfare in the kitchen area is to do several things. One, get germ-resistant sponges. Use disinfectant cleaners for the kitchen area, or just use a common household bleach on those areas when you clean and wipe areas. Now, they nowadays they make disinfectant cleaners specially made for the kitchen area, because most manufacturers realize the main battleground in germ warfare in the home is the kitchen. So use disinfectant cleaners is the real key here. Also use paper towels when you can to wipe up major spills, particularly juices from meat products, and then throw those germs away right into the garbage can.
How long do germs survive on surfaces?
Well, they can survive for hours or even days. In fact, they can even grow in your kitchen sink area where it's nice and moist.
And you're talking about E. coli or rotavirus, which
right.
is all over the place. That can live for hours and days?
Oh, yeah, even days on surfaces, particularly. Viruses can survive for a matter of days, ones that cause, like rotavirus, which cause diarrhea, for example. In the kitchen area, the main concern is bacteria, because they can regrow in your food, and you're always bringing them in on your raw poultry products. That's why you really actually have more fecal bacteria in your kitchen sink oftentimes than you do in your toilet, for that reason.
Now, most of us are not that anal about cleaning our kitchen or don't even know about some of the stuff that you're talking about, yet we seem to be healthy.
Well, two things. I think I should point out that cleanliness in the kitchen is really just using the right cleaning tools and right cleaning products. Use germ-resistant products and use disinfectant cleaners. It's really no more work. The other thing is most people don't realize when they actually get ill. Almost everybody has had the 24, 48-hour flu. Well, most of the time, that's really foodborne poisoning that they're actually getting, and they don't really associate it with mishandling in the kitchen area. In fact, we believe that 50 to 80% of all foodborne illness originate in the home. It's actually safer to eat out than in the home. So next time your neighbor invites you over, I'd suggest you take them out to dinner rather than eating over there. That's because most people don't recognize and realize the problem and where they're getting a lot of these illnesses. Foodborne illness costs this country over $23 billion a year, for example. So it is a significant problem. And we do miss a lot of days of work and inconvenience because of illnesses we can acquire from mishandling food in the kitchen area.
There was a recent recall of hamburger from Hudson Foods because of E. coli contamination. Now, that company didn't sound unusually negligent. In fact, it was a new plant and was rumored to be one of the better run outfits. What lesson did you draw from the Hudson Foods hamburger debacle?
I think what we've learned is we got to be really more cautious, because I think one of the problems we're producing meat products on a larger scale than ever before. And if a small error occurs now, large amounts of meat products can be contaminated. Where years ago, 100 years ago, you wanted a chicken, you went out in the backyard and grabbed it around its neck, and you made it for dinner. And if it had salmonella, only you and your family got ill. Well, today, if that chicken has salmonella or that cow has E. coli 0157, you ground it in with hundreds or millions of pounds of hamburger, it can contaminate a lot more hamburger and a lot more people that are exposed than ever before.
The World Health Organization endorses irradiation of food to prevent these bacterial outbreaks. What are the pros and cons of irradiation?
Well, actually, irradiation of foods has been studied for more than 30 years, and it's really a quite safe process. I think it's just always a concern of using radiation always bothers the consumer, and that's why you haven't really seen it at a large scale in this country, although it's used in other countries in the world. It's really perfectly safe to utilize. Unfortunately, sometimes doses may be higher than you like, and it may cause off flavoring of the food.
Let's talk about hand washing. I think we all know now it's good to wash our hands. We should do it more, but apparently we don't do it right.
No, one, we don't do it right. That's probably the best defense in germ warfare you can use is washing your hands, because you literally pick up germs all the time, and you bring your fingers to your nose and your mouth many, many times, hundreds of times for small children a day. So that is your best chance. You can never wash your hands enough, according to some people. Unfortunately, many people, when they go to the bathroom, don't wash their hands, and they can literally transfer these germs to various locations. And I think not only going to the bathroom, but any person making a meal should always wash their hands before they start the meal and after they handle any raw meat products. The best way to wash your hands is really to scrub it for at least 30 seconds, remembering to point your hands down into the sink so any drops go down in the sink and they don't run onto your wrist, and wash in between the fingers. That's really critical for that, and even the nails. That's the best hand washing procedure that you can use.
There's so many antibacterial soaps out there on the market. Are they really effective?
Well, they are effective against certain types of bacteria that can cause foodborne illness and skin infections. But generally, you can just wash your hands long enough and you can achieve the same job. Just remembering to wash your hands for at least 30 seconds to a minute, and you can do a really good job. But they can help certain people with dermatitis and remove certain types of microorganisms over time, particularly some of the newer soaps and that leave a residual on your hands. So you have some residual effect for certain types of bacteria.
Is it possible that we'd overuse these antibacterial soaps and create the same kind of situation we've created with the overuse of antibiotics, that we'd create resistant strains of bacteria by using all this stuff?
That's a good question. But no, the answer is no. We've been using chlorine, for example, which is common household bleach, for more than 100 years, and we have no evidence that any microorganism has developed any resistance. Disinfectants are much different than antibiotics. Disinfectants are like using a stick of dynamite to blow up a cockroach. It really just whacks the organism so heavily from so many different directions that it really doesn't have a chance to develop any type of resistance. And there's really no evidence of that. You use more household bleach in your swimming pool in a year than you would use in a lifetime in your kitchen. And we've never seen any type of organism really develop any resistance to disinfectants. In fact, proper use of household disinfectants will actually save on the use of antibiotics, because you will have to use less antibiotics if you actually do get ill.
Now, you've also spent a lot of time investigating public restrooms. What have you found? Who has the unhealthier bathrooms, men or women?
Well, definitely women win out by a long shot. Women, you can find more bacteria that could potentially make you ill in a woman's restroom than you can in a man. I mean, it's really keeping me out of women's restrooms the rest of my life from what I found out. Why? That's a good question. We really don't know. Perhaps women bring more children into the restroom, or may have less sanitary habits, or maybe women use the restrooms much more than men. I really don't know for certain. We do know women certainly use more toilet paper than men, twice as much. Actually, American women use twice the amount of toilet paper as English women. American women are the biggest wipers in the world from what we can figure out. There are certain areas or hot spots in the public restrooms, too. These tend to be the sanitary napkin disposal, the bottom of the toilet seats, the sinks, sink handles, and the floor. Those are the most germ-laden areas. In our studies, we could isolate the salmonella bacteria in almost 6% of the sinks in women's restrooms.
Well, Charles, you shouldn't be in women's bathrooms anyway. when you're analyzing them, have you ever gotten in a little trouble?
Well, in the men's room, yes, I've had the police call me on twice. Not many people try to take water samples out of toilets, so I have had the police called on me a couple of times when we were doing that work. Actually, the cleanest restrooms tend to be restrooms in hospitals, particularly public restrooms in hospitals. The worst restrooms are gas stations, as you might guess. I'm surprised a new life form has never evolved in a toilet in a gas station, and then bus stations and airports. Generally, if there's only one stall, they tend to be the most heavily contaminated, and then having more stalls tend to help. If you have a lot of stalls, tend to use the first stall, because fewest people tend to use the first stall, and there's always a greater chance of finding more toilet paper there, too.
Charles Gerba is my guest. He's a professor of microbiology at the University of Arizona. We're talking about germs, microbes, and food contamination. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with environmental microbiologist Charles Gerba. You've also been called in as a consultant for the space program. What was their problem?
Well, usually one of the biggest problems in space is really, if you're going to have space station or colonies on the moon, is how rapidly you can circulate your waste material, particularly urine and wash water from taking showers and that. You don't have a lot of space in space to store urine and water before you have to recirculate it back to drinking water. So you want to do it as quick as possible. One of the things you got to learn to do is to take that water and turn it back into drinking water really fast, like in 24 hours, and make it not taste like wastewater. I guess that's the other thing you have to do. You certainly don't want to let any waste go out in outer space, because it's traveling at a very high speed, and you don't want to meet up with it again.
How do you do that?
You keep it. Well, urine and wash water, you circulate very rapidly back. But in terms of fecal material, you save it or find something that, with it to grow.
And is that what you did? You found something?
Oh, what we're actually evaluating, what we've looked at is how well you can take shower water and treat it and remove all the bacteria and pathogens that could potentially make you ill, and then reuse it as potentially as drinking water or hygiene water, like washing your hands or taking another shower.
And have you solved that?
Well, NASA does the problems on that, and they apparently have solved it. We've tested a lot of samples for them, and they seem to be able to do that. I don't necessarily recommend the same procedure at home.
Now, how safe is our drinking water?
Well, that's a good question. Several years ago, we felt it was reasonably safe. But advances in our ability to detect pathogens and more awareness of disease-causing organisms indicated that we do have major problems from waterborne parasites, particularly one called Cryptosporidium. Back in the early 90s, we had a large waterborne outbreak from Cryptosporidium in Milwaukee, where over 400 individuals developed diarrhea and more than 100 died. And this was a well-operated water treatment plant with the technology we currently believe would eliminate all waterborne disease in the United States. And since that time, we've had numerous waterborne outbreaks from Cryptosporidium, and they have also occurred in the United Kingdom, for example. Cryptosporidium is a parasite that's unusually resistant to disinfectants. In fact, you can't normally kill it with disinfectants as they're usually applied to drinking water. It's so resistant, we have to depend on filtration. And if there are large numbers of this organism in the raw water, we can't effectively remove it. Studies have indicated that maybe 20 to 30% of our finished drinking water in the United States have low levels of Cryptosporidium in it. Now, that doesn't mean you're always going to have an outbreak from Cryptosporidium, but these low levels may cause random cases of illness in the community, may go unrecognized as waterborne illness. So I believe we do have a concern there with drinking water in the United States that needs to be looked at to see if there we can deal with it. How important a problem is it? What do low levels of a parasite like Cryptosporidium mean in our drinking water? And also, the question arises, do we need better treatment processes for removing Cryptosporidium when we have large amounts in our raw drinking water supply?
Do you drink tap water?
Yes, I do. But I do have a filter device on it because I think it's only wise maybe to just be extra sure on that. But I think there are a lot of things we don't know about our drinking water with microorganisms that we do. I think there's been really too much concern about chemicals in drinking water. When we really look at the risk of you potentially getting ill, microorganisms are much more of a concern. In the area of groundwater, viruses are more of a problem. We have about half the waterborne disease outbreaks that occur in the United States every year are due to contaminated groundwater. And that's because the viruses are so small they can get into the soil and into your groundwater. And recent studies have indicated, nationwide studies on virus in groundwater, that it may be a fairly frequent occurrence in some areas of the country where they have hard bedrock, which allows for fractures where viruses can migrate long distances.
People with compromised immune systems, that's elderly people or people undergoing radiation treatments or HIV positive, they're advised to drink bottled water or use water purification devices because of this. Let's start with the bottled water. How do you know bottled water isn't just tap water with a fancy label?
Well, nowadays you really don't know on that, and you don't really know how thoroughly it's been tested either. It has to meet, though, EPA requirements for drinking water, so you can be assured that it's at least as safe as your drinking water. And usually most manufacturers add additional treatments such as filtration and ozone to be extra sure that organisms like Cryptosporidium or other organisms that can affect immunocompromised are actually killed. So there is some extra assurance. If you can read on the label that it's been ozone and filtered, that it's probably additionally treated to give you better assurance. But there really is no criteria right now for testing and assuring that the these organisms have been destroyed in bottled water or other types of treated water.
What drew you to germs?
That's a good question. Actually, I read a book one time called The Microbe Hunters by Paul DeKerf, where it was about famous microbiologists and how they were faced with all these detective stories of how to figure out how to control germs, where they originated, and what was causing the illnesses. Actually, most microbiologists in the public health area are really detectives all the time. What I study is how really germs are transmitted from one person to the other. How do they actually get there? How do they get through the environment? So it's always a fascinating detective story, particularly anytime you get a waterborne outbreak and you get to help and investigate it. You have to act very rapidly. You have to come in there and try to use your wits to figure out where to sample, where the organisms might be, what organism might it be when it hasn't maybe yet even been identified yet.
Now, you have children. How do you manage to raise them without making them insane?
Oh, well, I named my first one after a bacteria, Escherichia. So I think I got him adapted to a microbiologist as a father right away. Actually, they have been involved in my research throughout my career. In the early days, I used to save their stool and bring it into work all the time because I needed the samples for my research, particularly when you couldn't grow rotavirus in the laboratory originally. You had to get it from children's stools, and I knew exactly what age group they would start getting rotavirus diarrhea, so I used to always collect their stools. Unfortunately, they used to see me take their underwear and diapers and put them in the refrigerator freezer all the time, so as they got older, they started throwing their clothes in there, too. I had to break them of that habit, too. But I also was able to involve them in a lot of the research where we would go and study the occurrence of disease-causing organisms in rivers and lakes and that. We always seemed to make a vacation around some type of an adventure of looking for a microorganism in a river or a lake or a water supply or a food supply.
Charles Gerba, it's been a lot of fun and scary to talk to you today. Thanks.
Thank you.
Charles Gerba is an environmental microbiologist based at the University of Arizona. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the Brit pop band Oasis. This is Fresh Air. The most popular band in England right now is Oasis, five young men from Manchester, led by brothers Noel and Liam Gallagher. Oasis is considered the leading example in this country of so-called Britpop. The new Oasis album is called Be Here Now, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Everything about the new Oasis album is big. Its sound, its ambitions, the length of its songs, its presumptions. Songs blare on for 6 or 8 or 10 minutes with countless layers of howling guitar tracks melting into Liam Gallagher's yowling vocals. In the song I just played called My Big Mouth, Gallagher talks about, quote, a sound so very loud that no one can hear. Many times on this album, the band's simple, often very attractive melodies are overwhelmed by the grandiose production. At other times, though, this grandiosity suits the music just fine, as it does on a cut like Stand By Me.
Made a meal and threw it up on Sunday. I've got a lot of things to learn. Said I would and I believe in one day.
Throughout their career, Oasis has courted comparison to the Beatles. It's gone from expressing their admiration for the Fab Four in interviews to cribbing little snippets of melody and production style on some of their early recordings. More recently, the group repeated a famous provocation of John Lennon's by saying that Oasis is more popular than Jesus. The album title Be Here Now derived, Noel Gallagher says, from a phrase John Lennon used to describe the immediacy of rock and roll in an interview with Playboy shortly before his death. Gallagher seems unaware that Lennon was quoting a favorite phrase of the mystic Ram Dass. More broadly, Oasis has taken to brazenly appropriating Beatle lyrics, as they do on the album's first single, Do You Know What I Mean?
Step off the train on a lone at dawn, back into the home where I was born. Sun in the sky never raised an eye to me. They put on the tracks and they must be mine. Pull on the hill and I feel fine. Don't look back cause you know what you might see.
At one moment in that song, Liam Gallagher refers to himself in a phrase that goes, "The fool on the hill and I feel fine," thus managing to quote two Beatles songs in one line. Elsewhere on the album, there are references to The Long and Winding Road, to Helter Skelter, and Getting Better. It strikes us here in America as pretty silly and pointless, but over in England, where Oasis truly is the biggest thing since the Beatles, it must seem outrageous, rebellious, and daring. The very thing that expands Oasis's fame in their homeland is what limits their appeal in America. Just a few weeks after its release here, Be Here Now, filled though it is with often striking music, seems like a muffled explosion. The next big thing that never happened.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new album, Be Here Now, from the group Oasis. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy-Westman, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tannenbaum. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
If you ever find yourself inside a bubble, you gotta make your own.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, Canadian short fiction writer Alice Munro. She's won Canada's most prestigious literary award three times. She talks about life in the small towns of Ontario that are the setting for many of her stories. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.